Our mission Frontline Fellowship has been serving persecuted churches and working in war zones for over 30 years. We started in a military prayer fellowship in the South African Defence Force, and we saw the persecution of church across the borders. And for the last 31 years, it's been my joy to be winning soldiers for Christ, winning guerrillas for Christ, winning people who are on different sides of the various conflicts spread throughout Africa, all the way from South Africa, Mozambique and Angola, as far afield as Nigeria and Sudan. Providential history is absolutely vital. We need to understand history. We need to understand the times. We need to understand the past in order to better plan for the future. History is important because history tells us what has worked and what has not. And we need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. Revelation 11:15 says, "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. All nations will come and worship before you." The longer you look back, the further you can look forward. If we don't know our own history, we will simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices, and absurdities all over again. I'm concerned that in the 20th century, we have been derailed. Christian civilization has been hijacked. We have been derailed from the greatest century of missions, which was the 19th century, and the 20th century became the greatest century of persecution. If we don't learn the lessons of what went wrong and get back to where the church was when it was an eschatology of victory, a vision of fulfilling the Great Commission, applying the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life, ministering to body, mind, and spirit, that vision which drew the greatest century of missions results in the 19th century, if we don't get back to that, we could get into an even worse century in the 21st century. And so, and if we want to wander in the wilderness for another 40 years, until a generation will rise up who will believe God's promises and go in and take the land, then that's what will happen. Let's learn the lessons and let's be Joshua's and Caleb's, not like the unbelieving generation who died in the wilderness because they would not believe the promises of God. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. To be ignorant of what happened before you were born is to remain a child forever. It is not the remembered past, but the forgotten past that enslaves us. C.S. Lewis was pointing out that many people say, we are enslaved by our past. Well, we're only enslaved by our past if we don't remember it. If we do understand our past and we understand it rightly, then it liberates us. History is and must ever continue to be, next to God's word, the richest foundation of wisdom and the surest guide to all successful practical activity. The great reformer John Calvin said, histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives. 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6, speaking about in particular the history of Israel recorded in the Bible, but of course referring to history in general as well. "Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things." It's important in history not only to study the good, but the bad. The blessings of God that are upon obedience and the curse of God that are on disobedience, both are part of the covenantal responsibilities and results. Our responsibilities and God's consequences of either blessing obedience or cursing disobedience. These things are examples. Some are bad examples, some are good examples. And when we think of missions today and you think of, we have got to win the Muslims to Christ, we have got to win communists to Christ, we've got to win some pretty bloodthirsty people, and some people are absolutely aghast and are stunted and stumble and say, the job cannot be done, they're unreachable, it's impossible, it cannot be done. Well, let's look at one of the most bloodthirsty peoples in history and how they were won for Christ. How the Vikings were won to Christ is one of the most incredible examples of providential history, and it shatters all illusions and all stereotypes of what missions is and what missions should be. The Scandinavians were the last group of Teutonic people to abandon heathenism and to embrace Christianity. The Viking marauders from the pagan north wreaked havoc throughout northern and western Europe. Throughout the 9th and the 10th centuries, the Viking raids killed and plundered. They also established strong Viking settlements in Normandy, in England, in Scotland, in Ireland, in Iceland, in Greenland, and throughout the Baltic and in Russia. In fact, they traveled as far as the Americas, to what today would be considered Canada, to what they called Vinland. And you can see how far they went. They went through the Mediterranean. They went up into the Black Sea. They went all the way up the Dnieper and the Don and the Dniester and the Danube. And they went as far as Novigrad and the Volga. The Vikings were incredible explorers. They had these long ships, these open ships. They sailed on the open seas. They crossed the Atlantic Ocean, not only to Iceland and to Greenland, not only to the shores of the Americas. They fought 1,000 years ago against the Indians in Canada. And you can find in Canada today the settlements which Vikings undoubtedly inhabited. So 450 years before Columbus sailed the ocean blue, the Vikings had already crossed that ocean blue and had landed in the Americas. Alcuin wrote of the shocking Viking raid on the monastery at Lindisfarne in AD 793. Never before had such terror appeared in Britain as we now have suffered from a pagan race. Nor was it thought possible that such an inroad from the sea could be made. Behold, the church of St. Cuthbert, splattered with the blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all its ornaments, a place more venerable than all in Britain, has fallen prey to pagans. Soon a new prayer was added to the church liturgy. From the fury of the Northmen, O Lord, deliver us. At that time, probably nobody could have predicted that the violent Vikings would be conquered by the Prince of Peace and would become some of the most enthusiastic missionaries for the advance of Christianity. The Viking era is normally dated from the Lindisfarne raid of 793 to the Battle of Hastings of 1066. That is the period of the Vikings. And they settled huge sections of Great Britain. For example, the very town of Dublin was settled by Vikings. York was settled by Vikings. Large amounts of what today is understood to be England and Scotland are made up of Viking settlers. In fact, the original Hammonds were Viking invaders who invaded Britain in 1066. Although the Vikings were famous for their hit-and-run raids, many Vikings actually settled in the British Isles and deeply influenced English culture. The fact that we have a seven-day week is due to the biblical account that God created the world in 6 days and that he rested on the seventh. That is why we have a seven-day week. And revolutionaries have tried to change it. The French Revolution, the Russian Revolution tried to have a 10-day week, but I think you've noticed they failed. However, the days of the week were originally named by the Romans after their seven main celestial planets. And so you had Sunday, and Moon Day, and Mars Day, and Mercury Day, and Jupiter Day, and Venus Day, and Saturn Day. However, the Anglo-Saxons replaced four of these Roman celestial deities with the names of Viking deities. And so Tuesday is named after the Viking god of war, Tura Day. And Wednesday is named after the Viking god of war, Woden Day. So Wednesday is Woden's Day. Thursday was named after the Viking god of war, Thor. And Friday after the Viking fertility goddess, Frey. And so, your Tuesdays are named after Tyre Day, Woden or Odin, Wednesday, Thor's Day, Frey Day. And many English words have their roots in Scandinavian speech. Now, it makes sense that these words are actually Scandinavian words that have just been adopted in the English language. Anger, die, Well, that makes sense. They would have used those words quite a lot. Die. Scant. Ugly. Loose. Wrong. Low. Sky. Take. That's just very Viking. Take. Window. Husband. Happy. Thrive. Ill. Beer and anchor. Of course, they were very much seafaring people. And the word berserk comes from the name of a Viking soldier. So when he said he's going berserk, it means he's acting like a Viking soldier in battle. A berserker was a Viking soldier. Ansgar was the first great apostle to the north. When the Vikings were the terror of Europe, God placed a missionary burden on young Ansgar. And with his own money, Ansgar redeemed several Viking youths who were slaves. And he educated them to be his co-workers in bringing the gospel to their countrymen. And Denmark was the first of the great mission fields of the Vikings. Harald, king of Denmark, had been driven from his throne and had sought refuge from Louis I, the king of the Franks. And while at Louis's court, King Harald heard the gospel and turned to Christ and submitted himself to being baptized. And on the king's return to Denmark, Ansgar eagerly joined the king to preach the gospel to the Danes. At Hedeby, Ansgar built a small wooden church, but persecution forced him to flee the country. Sweden was next. Ansgar responded to a request from King Bjorn of Sweden early in the 9th century while the Vikings were raiding, plundering, and burning the coastal cities of northern and western Europe. They hardly seemed to be the place that you'd want to get called to as a missionary. The most feared people on the planet. Ansgar narrowly escaped with his life when the Norsemen burned the churches and monasteries of Hamburg. With two co-workers, Ansgar crossed the Baltic Sea to begin ministering in Sweden. And on the way, the vessel was plundered by pirates and they arrived destitute in Sweden. King Bjorn welcomed the Christians to Sweden and the first church was built in that country. Now Thor epitomized the gods of the Vikings. And at an assembly of the people, a question was debated as to whether the missionary should be allowed to continue to preach Christ and so invite the anger of the old Viking deities. And at a critical part in the discussion, an old Viking stood up and he declared with great force that it was clear that the Christian God is stronger than Thor. This decided the matter. And the missionaries received the freedom to continue to preach the gospel in Sweden, because Christ is mightier than Thor. Many people asked, why was God allowing the Vikings to invade the Christian lands and to burn and to destroy Lindisfarne and many of the great monasteries of the church? More than any previous invasions and crisis ever faced by the Christian church, the Viking raids wrought desolation throughout Western Christendom, worse than anything they'd ever faced. The Vikings laid waste to monasteries, to churches. They shook the churches to their foundations. There was a decline and a decay in the faith and the morals, which had set in long before the Viking raids began. And so many saw the fury of the Norsemen as the judgment of God upon a backslidden and often apostate church. The first resistance to the Vikings came in Wessex. Churches and monasteries were destroyed. Clergy and monks were slain. Church buildings lay vacant. Until, in the south of England, the West Saxons of Wessex, rallied by King Alfred the Great, steadfastly resisted. And ultimately, the Saxons, under King Alfred the Great, defeated the great Danish invasion. He did this first and foremost by spiritual revival and educational revival in England. And then he revived the laws of England, the dooms of King Alfred, based on biblical law, which was based on the Ten Commandments, upon the Sermon on the Mount, upon the case laws of Moses. And these dooms of King Alfred were the foundation for all statutes, for the later Magna Carta and all other restrictions on the powers of government. And he built the British Navy. The English Navy looks at King Alfred the Great as actually the founder of the English Navy, because to beat the Vikings, England needed a navy. And King Alfred started with that. And they beat the Vikings. The unbeatable Vikings were beaten by King Alfred the Great. And he, more than anyone else, can be looked at as the spiritual forefather of the Vikings. And he's the only king of England ever called great. And so the Vikings started to be converted in England, in Wessex actually. In 878, after King Alfred defeated the Danish army at Ashdown, he required its king Guthrum and 30 other of his leaders to be baptized as Christians. He said this, "I could have you all killed because I've beaten you, but I won't do that. I could do a treaty with you, but that's no good because you're pagans and you won't keep to the treaty. You must be converted, you must be baptized, and you must be discipled as Christians, or there's no point having a treaty with you because you would never keep the treaty otherwise." And so, in 882, another Viking leader in Lower Rhine region also abandoned heathenism and embraced Christianity, receiving baptism in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. This is the beginning of the conversion of the Vikings. They had to be defeated in battle before they could be won to Christ. And I've seen this also amongst the people I grew up amongst. I grew up in Rhodesia, amongst the Matabele in Matabeleland. And until the Matabele were defeated in battle by the Rhodesians, there wasn't a convert amongst them. Even though missionary Robert Moffat had worked for 40 years amongst them without a single convert, only once they were beaten in battle did they come to the Lord. I have many Zulu friends. The Zulus had missionaries, including from America, who labored for over 20 years without a single convert until the Boers beat them in battle and they saw that the Christian God was greater than their God. Only then did Zulus come to Christ. And so this is not too unique in church history. In the expansion of Christianity, frequently nations needed to be defeated before they could be converted. And to show you, just to depart for a moment, one of the great missed opportunities and one of the great errors in American history, I would say, and I'm not in any way supporting America's involvement in the Second World War, but at the end of the Second World War, when Japan was defeated, General MacArthur, who I think is one of the finest generals that America's had, and I generally would respect him, but he made a very severe mistake indicating the individualistic Baptistic tendencies and the very poorly developed lack of eschatology, really, of that generation. When America had defeated Japan, the Emperor of Japan came to General MacArthur, who is now the military governor of Japan, and said, "I suppose I must be converted to Christ." And General MacArthur said, "Oh no, that's a personal choice." What a missed opportunity. If he had understood the history of Europe and Africa and the Pacific for that matter, many nations only came to Christ after the king or chief was converted, and then they were all commanded to convert, and only then did the real evangelism, discipleship, take place, out of which whole people movements came. That is how the Vikings came to Christ. That is how the Russians came to Christ. That is how all the great peoples of Europe came to Christ. The king was converted, and then from that point, you started to see, like King Clovis of the Franks being converted and ordering all the Franks to be baptized. And this is not what saves them, but this is what makes them open to the evangelism and the discipleship out of which true conversions flow. And so, what a terribly missed opportunity. In 1945, something good could have come out of that hideous Second World War if Japan had been converted. Imagine if General MacArthur said, "Yes, like King Alfred, the price of your defeat is you must be converted to Christ." And if the Emperor of Japan had been converted to Christ, all of Japan would have been formally converted, and then real evangelism could have taken place. But that's taking application. Let me get back to the story. Duke Rollo of the Vikings and some of his followers received baptism and created the Duchy of Normandy. The Vikings were impressed by Christ. The ethics of Christianity were so radically different to the traditional Viking culture that it took literally centuries for the Scandinavian people to be thoroughly evangelized and discipled. One of the chief attractions was the conviction that Christ is a mighty victor who has risen triumphant over death. The power of Christ impressed the hardened Viking warriors. In Norway, the king commanded his people to be converted to Christ or be prepared to die. However, in Denmark and Sweden, the Vikings were converted more by persuasion than by force. Pioneer missionaries like Willibrord and Ludiger attempted to take the gospel to the Vikings, but with little visible success. Ansgar was the great missionary to the Vikings. It remained for Ansgar, born of Saxon parents in northwest of France in 801. He succeeded where others had failed. Ansgar was described as a sensitive child who led a devout life. He experienced visions and dreams, and he possessed a combination of humility, of self-forgetfulness, and of undaunted courage and energetic initiative. And he laid the foundations for winning Sweden to Christ. King Harald of Denmark was baptized in 826 in Mainz, and some of the first pagans in Sweden to request baptism included the leader of Birka, an island in Lake Mälar, not far from present-day capital of Sweden, Stockholm. Despite serious reverses and violence and destruction of churches, Ansgar did not give up. He persevered, and soon Danish missionaries were being sent to establish churches in Sweden. The Danes are the first to be converted. The Swedes are now being the second. And Ansgar's faithful work was continued by his disciple Rimbert, who ministered both amongst the Danes and the Swedes. And Rimbert was succeeded by Adelgar. We need to see ourselves as links in the chain. We need to have an understanding of being multi-generational. God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We need to think multi-generationally. We mustn't just think for our own generation. Paul entrusts the gospel to Timothy, commanding him to entrust it to other faithful men who will entrust to other faithful men. Multi-generational vision. The job will not all be done in our lifetime. And missions amongst the Vikings advanced in the face of tremendous opposition and persecution. Early in the 10th century, King Guillaume of Denmark, a determined enemy of Christianity, attempted to banish Christianity from his realm. Many ministers and missionaries were martyred at this time, and numerous churches were burned to the ground. But the Saxons championed the Christian cause. In the British Museum in London, you can see some of the Saxon armaments, their shields, their helmets, all of these preserved from the 8th century. This is the oldest church in England. It's built by the Saxons shortly after the Saxons were converted. This dates back to the 6th century and it's still functioning today, and I've been able to visit here too. As the Saxons grew in strength, they became champions of the Christian cause. When Henry became king of the Germans in 919, he sponsored numerous missionary advances and outreaches to the Danes. And after his victory, his military victory over the Danes in 934, King Henry compelled the rulers to accept Christianity. This was common. When Christians defeated pagans, they would require them to be baptized. Uni was encouraged by the king to renew the work of Ansgar. Gorham's successor, King Harald, looked with favor upon Uni's attempts to reassemble the scattered remnants of Christian communities on the Danish Isles and to bring in ministers to rebuild their congregations. This is a typical Danish settlement, such as they would set up in England. And you can see the military structure, the defensive arrangement, the strong sense of community in the way that they built their communities. And so when the Vikings were converted, they were converted as communities. And there was a very strong sense of, it wasn't just an individual, it was the whole family, the whole community being converted. King Henry's son, Otto the Great, became king in 936. And in 962 is crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And under royal favor, the church has experienced a wave of reform with a tremendous revival of devotion and enthusiasm. King Harald of Denmark extended his realm to become overlord of Norway. As he himself was baptized, he encouraged the spread of Christianity throughout his realms. The history of missions amongst the Vikings is of continued growth despite opposition. Harald's son Sven attempted to bring about a pagan rebellion against his father, who died in the struggle. Sven severely persecuted the Christians and repeatedly invaded England, where he died in 1014. In Sweden, a pagan king, Eric, arose, hostile to Christianity, yet the church continued to grow. The missionary Poppo won thousands to the faith. Odenkar, missionary from Denmark, strengthened the gospel work in Sweden. King Canute, many of you would have heard of King Canute, sponsored missions both in England and in Denmark. Under King Canute, the church was firmly established in Denmark, and Canute later became king over all of England. And under his support, missionaries from Germany established more churches in Denmark. And he commanded his subjects to all learn the Lord's Prayer, to be faithful in communion with the Lord. And the church in Denmark grew and deepened with strong ties to the Saxon churches in Germany and in England. Norway was going to be the toughest nut to crack because they were the most violent of the Vikings. The conversions of the Vikings in Norway was far more stormy than in Denmark. Throughout the 10th century, Saxon missionaries from England labored throughout Denmark, establishing mission stations and congregations. And from the time of King Alfred the Great, the revived churches in England experienced a dynamic vitality in missions to the Vikings. The Kingdom of Norway had been the creation of Harald Haarfagre, or Harald Fairhead, who died in 933. By much combat, he had established himself as the overruler of all Norway. A Viking king was not determined by his bloodline as much as by his battle skills. He had to be able to beat all challengers, and then he was recognized as the king. His sons, Erik Bloodaxe and Haakon the Good, you kind of get the idea from the names which direction they're going. They struggled over the succession. Haakon had been sent to England to study, and there he'd been converted, baptized, and discipled as a Christian. By 935, the young, tall, handsome, athletic Haakon had established his supremacy through combat, and he is accepted as king of all of Norway. And this is the beginning of the royal mission to win the Vikings in Norway. Haakon attempted to win his people to the Christian faith. Most of his immediate court were baptized. But later he sent to England for more missionaries and began to build churches in Norway. After reigning for 15 years, by the year 950, Haakon proposed to the assembly of landowners that they accept Christianity. And most of the landowners responded with such great hostility and vehemently refused to abandon the old pagan ways and even threatened to fight him. They began to place great pressure on the king to compromise, to participate in the pagan sacrifices. And facing open rebellion, King Haakon stalled. He stumbled. Very reluctantly, he ate some of the meat in a ceremonial feast organized by his landowners. And later, after being wounded in battle on his own deathbed in 961, Haakon declared his great remorse over his compromise and his desire to do penance for his sins of compromising by eating food offered to idols. It was a rocky road with a lot of reverses. You can't expect to win a tough, resistant people to Christ with one evangelistic crusade. That is very much the even jellyfish idea. Let's have a crusade and that'll solve all the problems. It takes a lot more than that. His nephew, Harald Krafel, succeeded the throne of Norway. And while he wasn't as enthusiastic a Christian as Haakon, Harald Krafel did pull down pagan temples wherever he went. However, there was misrule, and bad seasons led to a lot of the people to resent the faith because they were getting bad harvests. And so his championing of the faith actually did no good for it because he wasn't a very good leader. In 970, Harald Garfield was lured to Denmark and killed. And King Harald Bluetooth of Denmark made himself overlord of Norway and encouraged Christianity there. Bluetooth, I guess he didn't know about flossing. Olaf Tryggvason was the son of the King of Norway, born in 964. His great-grandfather was Harald Haarfagre, who had initially established the Kingdom of Norway. When Olaf's father was murdered in 968, Olaf fled his country with his mother. He was an adventurous youth. He is captured by slave raiders. He is sold into slavery. Olaf was rescued and he is raised in a Scandinavian colony in Russia. Olaf ended up in the court of Russia's Tsar Vladimir I, where he became a favorite of the queen. And when Olaf was just 12 years old, the Tsar put a dozen ships in his command and sent him off to battle. 12 years old. By the time he was 21 years old, Olaf Tryggvason was renowned as the ultimate Viking. He was tall, he was strong, he was handsome, he was unequaled in martial skill. He led a huge army of Swedish Vikings and a fleet of almost 90 ships to loot Holland. And after devastating the Dutch, he went to fight the French. And after a massive amount of death and destruction, wherever he went, his next target was England, where after the Battle of Maldon, near the mouth of the Thames, he forced the Anglo-Saxon king Ethelred the Unready, you can imagine why he got that title, to pay a tribute of 10,000 pounds of silver. After this, he moved north, plundering Northumberland and Scotland. He then attacked the Hebrides and the Isle of Man. He conducted raids in Northern Ireland and Wales and Cornwall and France again. With a fleet of over 94 ships, he again attacked England, killing and looting wildly, until King Ethelred offered him a further 22,000 pounds of silver. Off the coast of Cornwall, Olaf heard of a local fortune teller who was renowned to have a gift of prophecy. And Olaf rode to the remote rocky retreat and asked the prophet if he could foresee anything in his future. "Thou wilt become a renowned king and do celebrated deeds. Many men wilt thou bring to faith and baptism, and both to thy own and others' good. And that thou not doubt the truth of this answer, listen to this. And the old man predicted that Olaf would soon suffer mutiny from his men, and he would be wounded in this. He'd be carried to his ship on his oblong shield, and after 7 days he would recover and he would be baptized as a Christian. When the mutiny and the wounding and the recovery happened precisely as the hermit had predicted, Olaf sought the old man again to inquire how did he possess such knowledge. And the man humbly confessed, 'The God of the Christians has blessed me.' When King Ethelred heard of the conversion and the baptism of his tormentor, King Olaf, he sent the bishop and he sent his officials to present him with royal gifts and to offer Christian fellowship. In 995, news from Norway reached Olaf that the leader, Earl Haakon, the very man who had murdered his own father, had caused an uproar in the land by demanding the daughters of respected leaders of the community. And although Earl Haakon had originally accepted Christianity under threat from the German Emperor King Otto, he had since reverted to heathenism. He had restored many of the heathen temples. He had persecuted the Christians. Earl Haakon the Apostate had gone so far as to offer his best horses and his youngest son, a 17-year-old, as sacrifices to a heathen goddess. It was at this opportune time that Olaf, the great-grandson of King Harald Haarfagr, determined to leave England to avenge the death of his father, the exile of his mother, the slavery of his youth, and to end the pagan misrule of Earl Haakon. With just 5 ships, Olaf landed in Norway and claimed it for Christ. Soon word reached him that Earl Haakon had angered 2 landowners by attempting to seize their wives for himself. The growing resistance was greatly strengthened, and word reached them that Olaf Tryggvason was on his way to claim the throne and to deal with Haakon. Olaf was renowned as the Viking warrior without parallel. His height, his strength, his athletic stature, his superior skills in all the warrior arts, his boldness, his ruthlessness were renowned throughout the land, in fact, throughout the world. Earl Haakon fled and hid in a pit beneath a pigsty, where he was killed by his own slave. At a national assembly, Olaf was proclaimed king of all Norway. He then travelled throughout the land, consolidating his rule and attempting to Christianize his people. Many of his relatives became his first converts, and he appointed them as Christ's captains. "I will make you great and mighty men for doing this work. All Norway must be Christian or die." The scattered settlements on the west and east shores of the Oslo Fjord readily accepted baptism, but the people in the northern part of the Vik resisted the gospel. King Olaf challenged the followers of Thor and Odin to combat, and by the end of the year he had convinced everyone, Christ is greater than Thor and Odin. As King Olaf moved to the western and northern fjords of Norway, he challenged the heathen to swimming races, archery contests, and mortal combat, and he won every time. Olaf's message was to the point: repent or die. Those who chose to fight were quickly defeated by Olaf's superior strength and skill. King Olaf declared that the heathen gods were demons, the power behind the idols were evil spirits, and those who promoted idolatry and heathenism were banished from his kingdom. Those wizards and priests who resisted were killed. Some of the incorrigibles he marooned on a rock far off from shore at low tide. At Trondheim, which had been the stronghold of the late heathen king Earl Haakon, Olaf burned the heathen temples and destroyed the idols. The local chiefs rose up in rebellion against them. Olaf mustered a large army and, along with 30 ships, anchored in the river Nid. Olaf invited the local chiefs to a feast, where he indicated he would be willing to perform a heathen sacrifice. When the chiefs were gathered together, Olaf declared, "If I am to return to making heathen sacrifices, then I will make the greatest sacrifice of all. I will not sacrifice slaves, but men. I will sacrifice the greatest of men only." And Olaf then named the most prominent leaders of his opposition as his choice of the sacrifices. As the horrified heathen howled in protest, Olaf gave them a straight chance: baptism or battle. He held 11 of these leaders hostage until everyone was baptized. At nearby Trondheim, the local chief Einbeard demanded that the king offer sacrifices other kings before him had done. Olaf said he would do so. He walked into the temple and smashed the idol of Thor to pieces with his axe. He then killed Einbeard and persuaded the rest of the village to abandon the heathen ways and to be baptized as Christians. Further north, Olaf faced the strong opposition of Chief Raud the Strong. Raud mobilized his army and a fierce sea battle was fought, and Olaf's forces overwhelmed Raud's rebels. Raud escaped to take refuge in an island hideout in Salten Ford. And the narrow channel to the ford was turbulent, and for a week no ship could attempt to enter. As Raud attempted to mobilize his witchcraft against the king, Olaf summoned his bishops to read the Gospels and pray. And by some miracle, his ships managed to negotiate the treacherous and turbulent rocky entrance to the ford. And soon Raud was apprehended and brought before the king, who ordered him to submit to Christ. "I will not take your property," he said, "but instead I'll be your friend if you will make yourself worthy to be so." When Raud rejected Olaf's offer with vile blasphemies, Olaf had his men force an adder, a snake, down his throat. This was the last resistance to Olaf's crusade to eradicate paganism in Norway. Now he focused on winning Iceland to Christ. But before he could do so, in the year 1000, King Olaf was killed in the spectacular sea battle of Skald. The pagan queen Sigrid the Haughty was furious that Olaf had spurned her advances. She mobilized two pagan kings to trap Olaf off the coast of Denmark, and Olaf died as courageously as he had lived, rejoicing that he had succeeded in his mission to convince the Vikings of Norway to abandon heathenism, to destroy their idols, and to commit to following the Christian faith. Another prominent Norwegian king who consolidated the Christian faith in Norway was Olaf Haraldsson. In 1007, when he was just 12 years old, Olaf Haraldsson was sent out as a sea king to raid Sweden. Late in Denmark, Olaf joined forces with Thorkel the Tall, and together they launched raids on Jutland and Frisia and Holland and England. They tormented poor King Ethelred the Unready, who had already suffered so much at the hands of the earlier, previously unconverted Olaf Tryggvason. In 1009, Olaf and Thorkel attacked London and East Anglia, and they martyred the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they plundered the cathedral. And thereafter, Olaf raided Brittany and France and Spain. Then Olaf had a traumatic spiritual experience, and he saw a terrifying vision of Christ. Olaf abandoned his heathen ways. He committed to being a Christian in the fear of God. In 1015, he arrived in Norway and proclaimed himself king. He immediately proclaimed the Christian faith throughout Norway and built numerous churches, such as these magnificent wooden Viking churches that you can still see in Norway to this day. Olaf became known as the great lawgiver. With Bishop Grimkel, he established the Mosterlaw. And while most of Norway accepted this, Trøndelag continued with their pagan practices and incurred the wrath of King Olaf, who descended on the area, fining or executing offenders. At Gulbrandsdal, local pagans confronted him with a huge wooden idol of Thor. And Olaf distracted them by drawing their attention to the bright sunrise behind him as a herald of his god. And as his enemies turned to face the sunrise, one of Olaf's warriors smashed the idol of Thor and revealed that its wood was rotten. And as gold spilled out and large rats, which had evidently been living off the food offerings, scattered, King Olaf pointed out that the gold that they'd wasted on offerings to Thor's rotten idol would look far better on their wives and daughters as ornaments. This demonstration of Christ's superiority over Thor convinced the locals to be baptized. As one contemporary noted, they who met as enemies parted as friends. For 12 years, King Olaf ruled Norway and brought Iceland and the Faroe Islands to Christ. Most unpopularly of all, he outlawed the Viking raids, which had been considered an essential way of life. It was at this point that Denmark attempted to regain control over the previous colony, and Olaf was attempted and forced to flee. In 1030, Olaf attempted to liberate his country from the Danes, and at the Battle of Stiklestad, heavily outnumbered, more than 3-1, Olaf inspired his men with a battle cry, Fram, Fram, Christsmen, Krausmen, Konungsmen, on, Christsmen, Crossmen, Kingsmen. Olaf and his men fought boldly and bravely, but they were overwhelmed by superior numbers. The Vikings grew to regret their betrayal of King Olaf as Danish taxes and oppression intensified. So within a year, Olaf was popularly proclaimed a saint, and his remains were enshrined in St. Clement. And what he had failed to do in his life, he achieved in his death. He united and inspired his people to win their country's freedom from Denmark and to be united as an independent Christian kingdom. The cathedral in York was dedicated to St. Olaf. Olaf was regarded by many medieval leaders as an example of the ideal ruler. A church in Constantinople was dedicated to the memory of King Olaf, and the sword that he had wielded in the Battle of Stiklestad was hung over the high altar. Olaf is the last Western saint to be accepted by the Eastern Orthodox Church. The Vikings finally surrendered to Christ. By a combination of pioneer missionary work, royal favor, and combat, the ferocious Vikings were convinced to abandon heathenism, to destroy their idols, to abandon their aggression, to cease their violent raids, to submit to baptism, and commit to following the Christian faith. The Vikings came to be convinced that the Christian God is more powerful than all other gods. They saw how he answered the prayers of the Christians. They witnessed miracles. They saw how the Christian kings and missionaries were able to destroy idols and defy the heathen gods and taboos without suffering any ill effects. They saw that their pagan gods were powerless before the all-powerful Jesus Christ. Christ was honored and worshipped as a mighty warrior who had triumphed over all the powers of death and hell and the grave. He is the risen, ascended Christ, the King of kings and the Lord of lords, with all other authorities in subjection to him. Psalm 72 verse 11 says, yes, all kings shall fall down before him and all nations shall serve him. These are the kind of psalms and prophecies and visions which inspired centuries of missionaries to go out expecting nations to be discipled, kings to bow before Christ. What a great vision it is compared to the pathetic, dispensational, Arminian, antinomian vision of just snatching a few souls from the fire and producing other lukewarm, namby-pamby wimps, wets and weeds that can adhere to the Saddleback, Willow Creek, minimalist version of a pseudo-Christianity that is even jellyfish filleted of spine. We need a vision of a great God who deserves great obedience, to attempt great things for God, to expect great things from God. Their vision was nothing less than Scandinavia for Christ. And on recent mission trips to Scandinavia, I've had the joy of seeing many of these magnificent churches built by people of a great faith. This is not dispensational architecture. These people built to last for 1,000 years and more. In fact, this church was built 1,000 years ago. Magnificent churches. And the cross, I must say, my favorite flag in the world is probably the Danish flag. I love the Danish flag. What a great Christian flag. The Swedish and Danish flags, Norwegian flags. I love the crosses in the Viking flags. The prominence of the cross in every Viking flag serves as a dramatic testimony of the conversion of the Vikings. Denmark, Norway, Finland, now Iceland, Sweden, Finland, and do not forget the United Kingdom of Great Britain, which is a Viking state as well. The Normans who invaded England were Vikings. And so since 1066, the United Kingdom has been ruled by the Vikings, and the prominence of the cross in the flag of Great Britain makes it clear that they too are a Viking state. The Vikings, the 1066 invasion of the Normans or Norsemen, who established the Great White Tower, what you know as the Tower of London, the epitome of Viking power in England. This was built by the Vikings already from 1066 on. The Celtic cross reminds us of the Saxon faith that sought to resist the Vikings and won their Viking tormentors and enemies to Christ. In Minnesota, you can see a monument like this to the Vikings, because, of course, many of the people in Minnesota come from Scandinavia, which is why they're just so good at ice hockey and things like that. The term Viking comes from the Vik. You can see here the Vik are the people from the very corner. It looks like a lion leaping down the rest of Europe, Scandinavia, and that's what they really are. How the Vikings came to Christ, you can read this on our Reformation website, and on our table we've got some CDs on. If you go onto the reformationessay.org website, there is a bundle of great historical articles and 85 of our PowerPoints on different aspects of our history. We've got on audio MP3s different aspects of history. The book Victorious Christians looks at these Christians who changed the world. I believe we've got to lift up these examples of excellence from the past again to just show how far short our present very dull, minimalistic type of Christianity in the West falls short of the biblical standard and the standard of most of church history. We need lives of courage and faith. We need to follow the examples of the heroes of the faith who were soldiers for Christ. And we are going to have to fight again. Islam has declared war on us. We need to raise warriors for the faith. We cannot continue as we have been. The church today needs to be reformed. We have to get back to the Bible. We must aim at nothing less than America for Christ, Europe for Christ, every area of life to be won back to the Lord. But I trust that these examples of the Vikings, the greatest of the warriors, the most ferocious of fighters, who could bow to Christ, recognizing Christ is greater. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. He is the Conqueror. He is greater than all, and he deserves everything that we have. This is Lindisfarne Island. This is where the Viking raids began. This is the Church of St. Cuthbert. And you can still see the wreckage today caused by the Viking raids. But yet, you can go to Scandinavia and you can see these magnificent churches, the clear faith, the devotion, how the Vikings were won to Christ. Now in Normandy, some of what the Norsemen in Normandy established, and from there they went to take Great Britain, and of course some of them came over here to the United States of America as well. And so this is some of our heritage, and if we want to know our heritage, we can't just go back to South African or American history, we've got to go back to European history, because our history didn't start in the 16th or 17th centuries. Our history has been going back all the way till the beginning of time, and the further back we can see, the further forward we can plan. May God bless each one of you. Amen.
I don't know what that says about us. Not something very good. But I do have a couple of announcements. Mary Ann Shepherd is going to come up right now and give some instructions for the people in the next drama. And immediately after that, if we could clear this room, there's going to be a mic practice for the next play. So So Marianne, if you would come up.
If you're in a George Mueller drama, the next block, we're not in that one, but you're free to go
for the
break right now. But as soon as
the break's over
and the next block starts, all of you need to go down to the chapel